The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Good morning. If you were judicious enough to sit towards the front, you've probably received a handout at this point, but we are short on copies, so if you don't have one, you may want to make a new friend, or if you do, maybe snap a photo and pass it on. The handout may or may not be very important in the course of this talk. It'll be okay. I do want to thank you for coming this morning. There is something really difficult, maybe the greatest difficulty that I experience at ACCS conferences is deciding what talk to attend. You look out, you get the booklet out, and you look down the list of topics, and you think, ooh, that's good. Oh, that one's good too. Oh, all three of those, how am I going to decide? And then you see your name, and your heart sinks. Oh, I got to go to that one. But none of you were in that position, so I really am grateful. Maybe Greg Wilbur just filled up, ran out of seats next door, and you came on. Thank you for that. So welcome to Stage or Subject, Embracing Dialectic to Make Sense of Logic. My name is Sean Johnson. I have been teaching classically for nearly 10 years. I currently teach upper-level humanities classes at Trinitas Christian School in Pensacola, Florida. And I am also the associate editor for Forma Journal, which is a quarterly magazine published by the Searcy Institute and dedicated to the intersection of classical thought and contemporary culture. Incidentally, the Searcy Institute has a booth up in the vendor room, so if you have time to stop by and chat them up and see what they have to offer, you won't be sorry. And now that I have finished with my shameless plug, I will move on to my first disclaimer, which is this talk won't be very practical. If you came for something practical, sorry. Maybe I'll pepper some things in at the end. But I say that a little apologetically, but not too apologetically, because the liberal arts in their essence are not practical. The servile arts are practical. Learning to make bricks is very practical. But at the end of the day, what you can do then is make bricks. The liberal arts are liberal. They are free. And they're the thing that, in days gone by, only a free person with some free time could pursue. So practicality, I eschew practicality. My second disclaimer is that though I am presuming to give a talk on logic, I do not teach formal logic. I am a student of the liberal arts, though, and my goal is to be training my students in the art of logic through every subject I'm teaching them. In fact, my only real goal in this talk is in some small way to encourage you as you endeavor to do the same, or maybe to convince you to try. And that leads me to the titular question of my talk. How should classical educators, and by extension, classical students, classical parents, classical administrators, etc., think about logic? How should classical educators think about logic? Is it best conceived of as a formal academic subject with its own textbooks and listing in the school curriculum guide? Should we think about it primarily as a stage in child development? Is there some essential but mysterious link between logic and 13-year-olds? Well, you've been warned already that I intend to talk about dialectic, and here I'm already about to make my first dialectical move. Considering two opposing theses, I'm going to dismiss them both in favor of a third. Without wishing to diminish the value of formal logic as a subject, or of associating logic with a particular stage of educational aptitude. My aim today is to argue that we should understand and appreciate logic best as what it is in its essence, an art that transcends both stage and subject. While I'm on the subject, let's remind ourselves very quickly that there are 7 liberal arts in all, and while mastery of all 7 is what constitutes a true classical education, they are divided into 2 groups, the trivium and the quadrivium. The trivium, or the 3 ways, contains logic, and I'm going to ask for just a little bit of class participation, and this is an easy one to get your feet wet. What are those other 2 arts in the trivium? Oh, good. You guys are, yeah, wowee. You're all stars. That was to boost your confidence. Good. Grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And then we come to the quadrivium, which is kind of like the mysterious east of the liberal arts. And it consists of 4 more ways or arts. This is a little bit trickier. What are those? What are those 4? Yeah. And astronomy. Yeah, good. Arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. They round out the 7. And if we had more time, we could fill a great deal of it with discussion of the natures of these 2 groupings, why they are distinct from one another, how they relate, and so on. As it stands, we must confine ourselves to the art of logic. Before we can discuss logic as an art, though, we have to deal with 2 sets of obstacles that tend to obscure its meaning. The first has to do with popular usage of the word, and the second has to do with how we as classical educators have tended to approach logic. First, the word itself, logic. If you ask the average man on the street to define logic, what kind of definitions do you think you would get? Common sense? Reason? Rationality? Yeah, good. Any last shots? No, that's what I would expect. In fact, there's usually, when the word logic is thrown about casually, there's often a kind of appeal. Hey, think logically about this. Be reasonable. Use your common sense. And, of course, there is something helpful about that man-on-the-street definition. Logic should have something to do with orderly thinking or with conforming your thinking to some rational standard outside of yourself. So when someone says, be logical, they are, in a sense, appealing to some common standard. Hey, let's both think along these agreed-upon lines or play by the rules that everyone agrees to play by. Unfortunately, things are never quite so simple. There is also the popular connotation of logic as impersonal, even harsh. I think of Mr. Spock from Star Trek. You guys don't watch TV. These are classical educators, so that's fine, but Star Trek is a show about, don't worry about it. Anyway, I think of Spock with his stoical logic, and we use adjectives like cold and dispassionate to describe it. So the term itself comes with some real baggage, but I'll argue that that isn't where the greatest problem lies. And this is where I'm going to make some enemies, probably. The second obstacle is a little more complex and a little touchier, partly because it involves one of the patron saints of the present classical education movement, Dorothy Sayers. And because I'm not actually trying to hate on Dorothy Sayers, I chose a portrait where she's looking as cool as she possibly could. If you are here at an ACCS conference, sitting in a talk on logic, no less, still scratching my head about that one, There is a strong likelihood that you have read or at least are familiar with the argument of Sayre's essay, The Lost Tools of Learning. In it, she offers the three liberal arts of the trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, as the instruments of an educational renewal. And while she did not live to see her recommended reforms implemented, at least fully, they have nevertheless become a shaping influence upon the movement we are all presently involved in, and are likely an indirect cause of your presence here today. Unfortunately for us and for Sayre's, our implementation of her insights has led to some muddying of the curricular waters in classical education. I think this is less the fault of Sayre's and more the fruit of misreading her over time. Let me point out a few key passages from her essay to demonstrate what I mean. Two that I've highlighted on the slide in front of you, but a few others, including this one. She writes, "Is it not the great defect of our education today that although we often succeed in teaching our pupils subjects, we fail lamentably on the whole in teaching them how to think?" And this statement is particularly relevant to a discussion of logic because it is arguably much easier to conceive of a narrow, concrete subject than of something as broad and vague and nebulous as how to think. P's and Q's are easy to pin down and get into a textbook, but how to think is kind of like the tomato seed on your fork or on your plate. You can't quite get it with your fork. She goes on to say, "The whole of the trivium was in fact intended to teach the pupil the proper use of the tools of learning before he began to apply them to subjects at all." And while this is true, the practical fallout of the idea is sometimes that logic is kept so far from being a subject itself and spread so thinly across all other subjects that there is little room left in our understanding for logic to exist as a concrete entity with its own identity. She then says, "Now it seems to me that the layout of the trivium adapts itself with a singular appropriateness to these three ages. Grammar to the Poll-Parrot, dialectic to the Pert, and rhetoric to the poetic stage." This is probably the most pivotal sentence or statement in that essay. And although she confusingly begins to use the names of the arts and ages interchangeably later in the essay, she initially makes her approach very clear. There is a significant correspondence between the liberal arts of the trivium and the three ages she defines, but they are not identical or synonymous. The layout of the trivium adapts itself with a singular appropriateness to these three ages. That's all. I think that through misreading Sayre's on this point, or because we become distracted by the difficulties of implementing it, we relegate logic in practice to a narrow period in the life of the student. I would even wager we begin to think of logical activities as stepping stones from grammar activities and to rhetorical activities, thus subordinating the art of logic to the art of rhetoric when the two should be complementary and co-equal. But more on that a little later. For now, let it be enough for me to suggest that logic could do with a fresh look. G.K. Chesterton wrote a short story called Man Alive. Anybody read Man Alive? You guys are the best. The rest of you, talk to those people with their hands up. Figure out what's up. In which the eccentric, innocent Smith travels all around the world. He also gets into some legal trouble, but it's cleared up in the end. He's innocent, after all. He travels all around the world just so he can come back to his own home from a different direction and gain a new appreciation for it by seeing it in a new light. It's nice to come in the back door instead of the front door for a change. He also returns again and again to court his own wife under different assumed names for a similar reason. That might get tricky if you actually tried that, but the approach may work here. One way for us to take a fresh look at logic, then, is to imitate Innocent Smith and employ a different name, and I suggest dialectic. Historically speaking, dialectic was actually the earlier name given to the second part of the trivium. Eventually, though, the two names became interchangeable. That development creates its own confusions, admittedly, but ultimately it's helpful having a different angle of approach to this liberal art. For example, I mentioned logic's popular reputation as dispassionate and impersonal. Dialectic, on the other hand, by its very name, draws our attention to the relatability of the art. A dialectic implies a dialogue, and that in turn implies relationship and communication, as we'll see. To move on, I'll quote just once more from Sayers, and though I have wanted to give her the benefit of the doubt, I do offer this last passage as one place where I'm not sure she has been entirely helpful to our thinking about logic or dialectic. She writes, "Logic is the art of arguing correctly. Indeed, the practical utility of formal logic today lies not so much in the establishment of positive conclusions as in the prompt detection and exposure of invalid inference." That's her definition of logic in a nutshell. The art of arguing correctly. The practical utility of formal logic today lies not so much in the establishment of positive conclusions as in the prompt detection and exposure of invalid inference. While logic is certainly concerned with valid argumentation, historically this has not been the only or even the chief goal that dialectic has aimed at. Compare Sayers' remarks to some other contemporary definitions of dialectic from classical educators or thinkers. Robert Littlejohn and Charles Evans make the following comments about dialectic in their book Wisdom and Eloquence, A Christian Paradigm for Classical Learning. "It is worth repeating once more that the trivium is not, as some have presumed, a pedagogical method." Ooh, shots fired. "But a collection of linguistic disciplines that incorporate a particular body of knowledge and whose study imparts a particular set of transferable skills." Dialectic comprises the two complementary elements that define the first three liberal arts: a distinct body of content and a set of transferable skills. The formal logic curriculum is important, but there is a very real danger that if broad principles of analysis and argument are not integrated into the student's overall academic habits, much of the logic course is a wasted exercise. Logical thinking, they finish by saying, like math, computation, or essay writing, is a cumulative discipline that cannot be gained in a semester or two, end quote. Littlejohn and Evans are clearly sensitive to some of the possible implications or potential misreadings of Sayers that I've already pointed out. And yet, though they insist that the trivium is not a pedagogical method, their language is still very methodological. Note the talk of skill transfer and the comparison to other methodological practices, such as math computation and essay writing. In their very helpful book, The Liberal Arts Tradition, Kevin Clark and Ravi Jain, if you're noticing a trend here, it's tackling the liberal arts is not often a job for one man. I should have tried to give this talk with a partner. Kevin Clark and Ravi Jain define dialectic as simply the art of reasoning. The art of reasoning. While they do not have the space to develop that definition, they do go on to add that an essential component of learning dialectic is the study of logic, which, from 300 BC until well into the 800s AD, was synonymous with studying Aristotle's logical writings collected as the Organon. The Organon, or Organum, translates to an instrument or tool of thought or learning. And this is, by the way, just further evidence that there's probably more going on in Sayer's essay than we realize. The lost tools of learning, the lost organon. I think she's got Aristotle on the brain and she just doesn't admit it. But I digress. She's so cool. Note that Clark and Jane actually identify logic as a sub-discipline that is merely a part of broader dialectic. And finally, Sister Miriam Joseph, professor of English at St. Mary's College, writes, "Logic is the art of arts because it directs the very act of reason, which directs all other human acts to their proper end through the means it determines." Her definition, while also brief, includes not only the idea of logic directing our reason, but directing all of our acts to some proper end. She's really started to introduce value language into the equation. To get a sense of what that proper end is, let's back up for a moment and briefly consider the history of dialectic. I present to you an allegory of the seven liberal arts. And I wonder if anyone can spot logic. Again, if you're in the back, I'm really sorry. There's some gray spots up here. But anybody spot logic? It's tricky. This is a wacky allegory. As a teacher, you'd love to get that one kid in class who's just the bold guesser. Half the time, he doesn't know what he's talking about.
The one with the
lute. Yeah. You remember the music was on the list, right? That's, I know him. I can shame him. It's okay. The woman, the young lady, the timeless lady, in the upper left-hand corner is logic or dialectic. And I think this allegory of the liberal arts helps maybe make my case that logic is tough to pin down. Some of these ladies have a lot of fun props. So yeah, music is playing the lute, grammar hands out books and teaches the kids to read, and rhetoric is, she's up in the top right and she's swinging a crazy stick around, and astronomy is sitting on her inverted globe, and geometry is measuring her own globe down here, and arithmetic, well, is doing some figures or doodling in the back of algebra class or something. And logic has a bird on her head and a snake on her arm. we can't tarry too long on those objects. However, the bird, as I'm given to understand, can often represent, sometimes logic is actually depicted with a dove, as if to signify divine inspiration. And the serpent, it's harder to see, but geometry also has a serpent coiling around her globe. The serpent is often an indication of what we would think of biblically as discernment, shrewdness. The Bible defines it over and over again. Actually, it's the thing that the tree in the garden promised Adam and Eve. The ability to distinguish or divide and discern, categorize good and evil. And so geometry is discerning and dividing up the physical world. And logic is also represented with a serpent because she is often concerned with dividing the forms, categorizing and distinguishing between the world of the forms or the immaterial. But before we delve into the history itself, a brief digression. I think that coming to a clearer understanding of logic really requires some clarification about grammar as well. In the classical renewal, that period of classical education that we in the ACCS occupy and partially represent, grammar is thought of as fairly simplistic or elementary for obvious reasons. In fact, grammar and elementary are often interchangeable terms when we talk about the makeup of our schools. Oh, she's going into elementary school. She's going into grammar school. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but I think that when we say either word, we are still saying a little more, or possibly meaning a little less, than we realize. The ancients and medievals conceived of things as far afield as physics and allegorical readings of scripture as belonging to the art of grammar. In other words, they did not conceive of grammar as simply learning the mechanics of a language, or even of learning language in general, though it is easy to see how that mistake could be made. Rather, grammar is best understood as the learning and interpretation of signs, more generally. The letters, syntax, and vocabulary of a language certainly qualify as signs. But so, too, do many elements of the physical world. Narrative details in works of literature, even the phenomena of our day-to-day experiences. And because these things would lose their value if they could not be remembered, practicing the art of grammar does indeed have a great deal to do with memory, or, as Dorothy Sayers speaks of it, stocking the mind's storehouse of knowledge. If nothing else, this nuance in our definition of grammar helps to stress the fact that it is not merely stage one in a process, the bottom floor in a building where only the penthouse holds any real interest for us, or the bottom story of Mount Purgatory to be traversed, ascended, and never revisited. It also stresses the fact that while grammar does provide material for logic to work upon, conceiving of that material too narrowly can directly impact how we conceive of logic itself. But back to the history. Marshall McLuhan, philosopher on the media, best known for coining the term "the medium is the message," actually wrote his Cambridge doctoral dissertation on the arts of the classical trivium. And he observed that the history of the trivium is largely a history of the rivalry among them for ascendancy. This is a big claim that I don't have time to unpack fully, but it is interesting that this cannot be true if the arts are inherently hierarchical. If logic, in its truest sense, is merely the ladder rung between grammar below and rhetoric above. So, a brief history of maybe that rivalry and certainly of dialectic and its development. Dialectic probably began with the pre-Socratic Heraclitians. Dialectic was devised by them as a means of tackling dilemmas rationally. But there was one problem or drawback. No outcome was applicable in the future because of the Heraclitian idea of flux. Heraclitus famously said, "No man steps into the same river twice. Things are always moving and changing. The world is never the same from one moment to the next, and you yourself are never the same from one moment to the next." Heraclitus was such a postmodern. No man possessed a fixed objective standpoint. So his perspective on any issue or situation was always unstable. If you are married and you ever, your teacher, so maybe not, but if you ever have the chance to eat out once in a while, there's often this, and maybe Netflix recreates this phenomenon too, there's this painful process of trying to figure out where to go. Or you're scrolling down the website and trying to figure out what to watch or what to stream. And sometimes you spend more time doing that than the actual eating of the meal or the watching of the movie. Imagine if every night you had to decide where to eat out for dinner, but the next night you were in a new city. That's sort of how the Heraclitians had to do dialectic. For them, if you've solved the problem yesterday, you're going to have to retackle it today because the terms have changed. Then came the sophists, who attempted to subordinate dialectic to rhetoric. They took an encyclopedic approach to dialectic, teaching their students scores and scores of categories and definitions so that they would be prepared to analyze and debate any issue that arose. In fact, that's how they would attract students. They would just walk into a crowd and offer to take up any question or proposal shouted out at random, because they too had stocked their mental storehouses with these logical categories that they had created for themselves. Their goal, though, was merely the persuasion of an opponent or an audience, regardless of whether they were defending a conclusion that was true or good. And I'm simplifying a little bit. The sophists, at least in their early days, said that they were interested in virtue. But by the time Socrates comes along, the sophists are sophists. Plato and Aristotle reacted strongly against this sophistic tendency. In fact, that's a possible reason that logic still gets a bad rap today as rather sophistic, a rather lawyerish art. Just doesn't matter whether your side is right or wrong, and just persuading people to agree with it. And instead, they gave us what we call Socratic dialogues. And in a Socratic dialogue, the format was of a two or many-sided conversation, taking up an issue and asking questions to test and challenge that thesis until it proved true or a better one could be offered in its place. The difference was in the goal of the dialogue. Those of you familiar with Plato's dialogues can attest that Socrates was not chiefly concerned with winning over his interlocutors, making friends and influencing people, maybe influencing people, so much as in revealing and correcting inconsistent thinking, and even more importantly, making sure their conclusions aligned with an objective external standard. And that standard was truth. Go figure. Because of their belief in fixed transcendent ideals, the forms, Socrates, Plato, and their followers developed dialectic into an art that aimed at truth and attempted to train minds to reason along the lines of truth. That trajectory really continues into the medieval period, where dialectic reaches its pinnacle in the scholastic philosophers, particularly St. Thomas Aquinas and his Summa Theologia. And if you are one of the fortunate ones, I'll ask you to make reference to your handout now at this moment. You may hold in your hand, sort of like reaching into your seat to see if there's a golden ticket, you may hold in your hand an excerpt from question 49 of Thomas's Summa, in which he takes up the cause of evil. I decided to pick a fun, non-controversial one. And this question is comprised of three articles, and I've chosen the second here. Article 2 takes up the more specific question, whether the supreme good, God, is the cause of evil. And this is how he begins, with several objections to the positive version of this question. Is the supreme good God the cause of evil? Well, here are some objections that would say no. It would seem that the supreme good God is the cause of evil. For it is said, I am the Lord and there is no other God, forming the light and creating darkness, making peace and creating evil. And Amos 3:6, shall there be evil in a city which the Lord hath not done? Objection 2, further, the effect of the secondary cause is reduced to the first cause, or blamed on the first cause. But good is the cause of evil, as was said above in Article 1. Therefore, since God is the cause of every good, as was shown above, it follows that also every evil is from God. If he causes every good, and some of those goods cause evil, it's God's fault. Objection 3, further, as is said by the philosopher, that's Aristotle, and if you ever get good enough to be called the anything, man, the brick maker, that's something. The cause of both safety and danger of the ship is the same. Just sailing a ship, the captain undertakes a lot of risk to do the thing he's supposed to do, which is get from point A to point B. It would be much safer to keep the ship in the harbor the whole time. Maybe. Or in dry dock. Forget about it. But God is the cause of the safety of all things. Therefore, he is the cause of all perdition and of all evil. On the contrary, Augustine says that God is not the author of evil because he is not the cause of tending to not being. I answer that. This is the part where Thomas gets to talk. As appears from what was said, the evil which consists in the defect of action is always caused by the defect of the agent. But in God, there is no defect, but the highest perfection, as was shown above. Hence, the evil which consists in defect of action, or which is caused by defect of the agent, is not reduced to God as to its cause. But the evil which consists in the corruption of some things is reduced to God as the cause. And this appears as regards both natural things and voluntary things. For it was said that some agent, inasmuch as it produces by its power a form to which follows corruption and defect, causes by its power that corruption and defect. And you can read the rest after class. But the thrust of it is, Thomas has done several things here. He's introduced one position. He has then interposed an alternative position. And from those two opposing theses, he has drawn a third unique position that looks to do justice to both of the original positions, both the objection side and the on the contrary side, and yet go further than either of them. And notice, too, where do his objections come from? Is he making those up? Where do they come from? Scripture? Yeah, they come from classical primary sources, essentially. They come from the great tradition. So Thomas is doing several things here all at once, and that's what makes it so wonderful. He is compiling. He's doing something very grammatical in that sense. He is compiling the material of the great tradition, the permanent things, as we heard this morning. And then he's putting them in conversation with each other, with one another. And then going further in a particular direction towards truth, I would even say. Originally a tool for discovering truth in the Middle Ages, dialectic came also to be used as a means of arranging and ordering what is already known to be true, in order to arrive at higher truths. Unfortunately, at the end of the medieval period, logic is supplanted by geometry. The Cartesian Revolution makes empirical, analytical geometry into the sole means of knowing and measuring and dividing and classifying and accessing the truth. Hundreds of years earlier, though, the Neoplatonist philosopher Plotinus explains why an empirical art like geometry could never do for man what dialectic is capable of doing. He writes in the 200s, "Dialectic is the method or discipline that brings with it the power of pronouncing with final truth upon the nature and relation of things." That's a great line. The power of pronouncing with final truth upon the nature and relation of things. What each is, how it differs from others, what common quality all have, to what kind each belongs, and in what rank each stands in its kind, and whether its being is real being, and how many beings there are, and how many non-beings to be distinguished from beings. Plotinus would have no problem sorting out what's a boy and what's a girl. Dialectic treats also of the good and the not good, and of the particulars that fall under each, and of what is the eternal and what the not eternal. And of these, it must be understood not by seeming knowledge or sense knowledge, but with authentic knowledge. All this accomplished, it gives up its touring of the realm of sense and settles down in the intellectual cosmos, and there plies its own peculiar art. Now it rests. It is no longer busy about many things. It has arrived at unity, and it contemplates. It leaves to another science all that coil of premises and conclusions called the art of reasoning, much as it leaves the art of writing. Some of the matter of logic, no doubt, it considers necessary to clear the ground, but it makes itself the judge, here as in everything else. Where it sees, it uses. Anything it finds superfluous, it leaves to whatever department of learning or practice may turn that matter to account. Geometry, Plotinus implies, is too earthbound to do what dialectic is capable of, that is, of directing man's intellect upward to the realm of the transcendent. So we come finally to the function and aim of the art of dialectic. Plotinus is also explaining that logic is formal. It allows us to discern and perceive forms, the true nature of things. Grammar interprets, but logic must be prior to grammar, because we must apprehend before we interpret. For example, if you ask in a debate or discussion, what do you mean, or what kind of thing is that? You're asking a logical question that precedes interpretation and memory. In the preface to his work, Art of Logic, the poet John Milton explains, the general matter of the general arts is either reason or speech. They are employed either in perfecting reason for the sake of proper thinking, as in logic, or in perfecting speech, and that either for the sake of correct use of words, as in grammar, or the effective use of words, as in rhetoric. Of all the arts, the first and most general is logic, then grammar, and last of all, rhetoric, since there can be much use of reason without speech, but no use of speech without reason. If you teach middle schoolers, you might beg to differ, but it's a good point, generally. Logic, Milton says, is perfecting reason for the sake of proper thinking. And what does this perfecting reason look like? I thought we found an excellent example in this classic scene depicted here. Those of you in the back might have just as easy a time looking at this one. Anybody recognize this scene? The quote helps. They go together. Expect no longer words or signs from me. Now is your will upright, wholesome, and free. And not to heed its pleasure would be wrong. I crown and mitre you, Lord of yourself. This is, the artist is Salvador Dali. That's what's throwing you off. But this is a scene from Dante's Purgatorio. It's the parting words of Virgil to Dante before he disappears and leaves Dante to go on to bigger and better things. But Dali was commissioned by the Italian government to illustrate the entire Divine Comedy, and he got started and they looked at his stuff and they fired him. But he enjoyed the project so much that he finished, and they're worth checking out if you have the time. This is my favorite passage from the Divine Comedy, and it's the kind of thing that you want to be able to tell your students as you send them out into the world. Dante is not being set free as a libertine, though, to follow his heart, live his dream. And this is the essential principle for the Christian logician. He is only free to do as he pleases because he has had his reason perfected and now thinks rightly about the world. His mind can perceive the good and his will can freely choose it. He's been trained by logic to discern between what is good and what is evil. I don't think it's an accident that this moment comes for Dante after his baptism by fire. What Virgil is really affirming about Dante is that a mastery of logic now allows him to rightly perceive the Logos. For ancients, the capital L, logos, was that intelligible order which may be seen in the world and which comes from the beginning or source of all things. The pivotal revelation of our tradition is that Christ himself is that logos, the ordering principle of all existence. Pastor Wilson talked about that this morning, that Christ was the executive by which and through which all things were made, and so all things correspond to his nature. Thus, the ultimate aim of logic is knowing Christ, the logos, rightly. And incidentally, because he is the unifying principle of all things, it is the case that all liberal arts work together for the common goal of perceiving or seeing truth. However, it doesn't always go that way. And there are some risks, maybe, to putting logic in the hands of any human, much less an adolescent one. I give you two paintings. The one on the left is probably by a student of Rembrandt, and then the one on the right is Rembrandt's Aristotle with a bust of Homer. And if you have more time, you should look at a better image of it, and look at the way that the light plays between the main subjects in that painting. It's very dialectical. I take Pilate as maybe the worst case scenario for a classical graduate. In St. John's Gospel, he writes in chapter 18, "Pilate therefore said unto him," that is Jesus, "Art thou a king then?" Jesus answered, "Thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice." Pilate saith unto him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again. Pilate is clearly riffing on his own classical education in this famous question. Quid est veritas? What is truth? But he has fallen so far that he will not even stay for an answer. How does one get here? Alexander Pope famously wrote, "A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep, or taste not the Pierian spring. There shallow draughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again." Pope is speaking about an issue of volume. Maybe those guys who go up to Oxford for a year and then they drop out. Too much Gilbert and Sullivan and not enough lecture hall. But his words could very easily be applied to the great danger of teaching logic. Teaching the methods for proper reasoning without giving students the goal to aim at. We classical educators often talk of teaching students how to think. But, to be frank, if we are not also helping them know what to think, we run the risk of creating more little Pilates. And in print, Pilates and Pilates. They look very similar. I'm enjoying that right now. You should be too. But seriously, we run the risk of creating more little Pilates, merely inoculating them against truth, so that even when the truth incarnate stands before them and says, "Yep, I'm from Team Truth, and I'm here representing truth, and maybe I am the truth even," go so far as to say that, they use the tools we gave them to dismiss it and wash their hands of the business. Another loosely related danger inherent in giving our students the tools of logic is what Dorothy Sayers refers to as the dialectical hammer. And if I had a nickname, if you got to choose your own nickname, that would be it. Dialectical hammer, that's great. I was at a function put on for the benefit of our school once a few years back, and a charismatic parent from the school was given some of the MC duties. And I remember at one point he told this anecdote about being very grateful to the school for teaching his kids to come home and argue with him. And I remember looking around at several other fellow faculty members and exchanging nervous glances. Keep going? Or stop? It was the kind of awkward moment that makes this danger come home for me. Sayers herself warns, "All children sit in judgment of their masters. And if the chaplain's sermon or the headmistress's annual speech day address should by any chance afford an opening for the point of the critical wedge, that wedge will go home the more forcibly under the weight of the dialectical hammer wielded by a practiced hand." So, as she points out, young people they develop this innate and powerful instinct for criticism, for noticing hypocrisy, and if you equip them with the tools of logic, they will become a powerful, blunt instrument that may be turned against you, so watch out. The question then is how to temper and guide this. And I promised you nothing practical, so if you thought I was going to answer that question for you, sorry. If you have a good answer, we should talk after. Before the weight of that task settles too heavily upon us, let's turn to one positive and practical good of training our students in logic. In his book on the Trivium, Stratford Caldecott commends G.K. Chesterton as an apostle of dialectic, one who enables us to see that dialectics does not belong merely in academia, but in everyday life. As the tools for our lifelong search for wisdom and truth, dialectic belongs in the school and in the life of every child. Chesterton warns that if we are not able to think things out for ourselves, we will simply default to thinking the thoughts that others have thought out for us. Then we, and our children, are simply prey for those who will take the trouble to think things out. Some even get paid for it. Advertisers, politicians, and the rest. After all, logic is not a servile art, but a liberal art. And as we master it and put it to use in all of life, we will become free indeed. So, stage your subject. As I said, in the spirit of dialectical synthesis, I'll repeat my earlier thesis that logic is, in fact, something much, much greater than either, and that our task as classical educators is not to figure out how logic fits into our various disciplines, at least not solely, but how those disciplines fit inside of logic. Stratford Caldecott writes, "The many poetic or scientific or psychological or aesthetic or probable truths that make up our intellectual landscape are simply aspects of or means of approaching the complete truth. Part of the process of thinking is to learn how to set all these different types of approaches to truth in the right order, to see how they combine to give a more complete image of reality as a whole." So how do we train students in the art of logic and put it into practice in order to give a more complete image of reality as a whole? Admittedly, I'll say it again, I haven't prepared a bevy of practical applications for you. I would say you can do it in your curriculum. If you pitted whole works of great literature against each other, I have a strong hunch that Homer, in fact, intentionally created the Iliad and the Odyssey as dialectically opposing theses to be reconciled in the mind of the reader. I'd also commend dialecticians like Aquinas to you as models. Thomas worked tirelessly in his Summa to synthesize conflicting positions and salvage what value he could from them. Granted, writing things down was much rarer and more difficult in the Middle Ages, so medievals were hesitant to dismiss anything that had been worth committing to writing. More than that, though, I believe they understood that the world is a harmony, and that because it is made and sustained by the Logos, no attempt to harmonize disparate elements of the world is done in vain. So subject your students to synthesizing exercises. Give them contradictory propositions and tell them to make the two agree, even a little. Train them to be clear-thinking harmonizers. In a world of broken, partial truths, no activity could be more essential. Thank you. For the sake of time, I will omit my discussion of the books I've listed here, but if you want to get a grounding in the liberal art of logic or go further with some modern thinkers, these are great places to start. I've got time to take one or two questions, I think, before I dismiss you out into the world. But I'm happy to chat with you later on as well. Anything pressing at the moment? Perfect, I've stupefied you. Thank you again. I hope you guys have a wonderful conference.